a book club and podcast for anyone who wants to explore the best mysteries and thrillers ever written. I'm your host, Sarah Harrison.
And I'm your host, Carolyn Daughters. Pour yourself a tea or a gin and tonic.
But not a toxin.
No, and join us on a journey through 19th and 20th century mysteries and thrillers, every one of them a game changer.
Carolyn.
Sarah. Can you believe we've been doing this almost 1 year?
I cannot. It's unbelievable. Mm-hmm. You know what else is unbelievable?
No.
You just told me we had over 2,000 followers.
We have 2,000 followers on Facebook.
That's awesome.
I know. I feel pretty good about it.
I do. For those of you out there that we don't know, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for caring.
Yeah, now just ask some questions and stuff. And you could be our listener of the month. But first, what are we even reading this month, Carolyn?
This month, we are reading an awesome book. It is The Hound of the Baskervilles. Everyone's heard of it. If you haven't yet read it, you must. It is a quick read, and it is so much fun.
It is awesome. I think I read it in high school and then completely forgot it in, like, you know, the last however many years. And so it was all a mystery to me again when
the mystery,
I read it.
The mystery was a mystery.
Yeah, I loved that.
Yes. And so this gothic-inspired spine tingler includes a spectral hound and a hands-off Sherlock Holmes. In fact, he's not in part of the book, which I thought was kind of weird and also weirdly awesome.
Yeah, it was like he was there, though, because, like, Watson kept thinking about him.
Oh, Watson.
It was just like his presence was there, even though he wasn't physically doing anything. Uh-huh. It was interesting.
Yeah, it was published in 1902. It's considered by many people to be Arthur Conan Doyle's best book.
It was really good. I really enjoyed it.
So before we get into that book, The Hound of the Baskervilles, we want to thank our sponsor. And this episode, our sponsor is Grace Sigma. Grace Sigma is a Denver-based process engineering consultancy specializing in the intersection where business meets technology. Grace Sigma works nationally in industries such as finance, telecom, and government. They use lean methods to assist in documentation development, data dashboarding, storytelling, process visualization training, and project management. Whether you're a small business looking to scale effectively or a large corporation whose processes have become tangled, Grace Sigma can help. To learn more or to schedule a free consultation, email info@gracesigma.com. That's GRACESIGMA.com.
Thank you, Grace Sigma.
Grace Sigma sounds awesome. Small company, large company. Grace Sigma can probably help you out.
They can help everybody.
They can help everybody. And we also have a listener of the episode, and we have an award for this podcast episode. And that award goes to Brad Wetzler of Austin, Texas.
Ooh, Brad.
Thank you, Brad, for being a fan of Tea, Tonic, and Toxin. And to show our appreciation, we're going to be sending you a very cool sticker.
So it's a really cool sticker, and you can stick it to, like, lots of stuff.
You can, I mean, yeah, you know, like, not your kitchen wall or something, but
yeah, I
cooler.
Mean, if you want to get, like, really dicey, you can give it to your toddler and see where they stick it.
Yeah, it could be like a you know, contest, like, where will the toddler stick this?
Exactly where you don't want it. That's where they're going to stick it.
Yeah. If you would like your own on-air shout-out, and why wouldn't you? Because it's so much fun.
It's very fun. You can show all your friends we said your name.
Yes. We'll also send you an awesome sticker. All you have to do is weigh in. Tell us what you're thinking about the books we're reading. Tell us what you think about our upcoming 2023. That's a lot of numbers. 2023 books that we are about to share with you all. Just weigh in. You can weigh in on the website, on our comment forums, or on our Facebook page or our Instagram page. Our website's teatonicandtoxin.com, and our social media pages are @teatonicandtoxin.
Where else are you going to get a sticker just for saying stuff that you think?
Yeah, it's a real easy way to get a sticker, and they are very cool stickers.
Yeah, they're nice, high quality stickers, and more will be coming soon, so stay tuned.
We have been giving away so many stickers that we are running low on stickers.
I know, we're gonna get more stickers, and I think we're gonna get some special edition stickers, so,
and some swag. I mean, I don't know. I'm looking right now at a glass that has Teatonic and Toxin logo on it, book club and podcast.
It's a beautiful glass.
It's a weighty, heavy, I would call it a cocktail glass. There's probably a name for this glass.
I think it's called like a rocks glass. It's a short glass.
It's a nice, heavy glass. We're going to maybe in 2023 come up with a nice teacup or coffee mug.
We've got ideas.
We've got a lot of ideas.
So stay tuned for awesome swag.
Yeah. So, Sarah, tell us about the Hound of the Baskervilles. You know, first of all, readers, listeners, we like to go through a quick summary just so we're all on the same page. We know not everybody has read the book as recently as we have. So we're going to kind of get everybody, you know, on the same page.
Wait, are we spoiling this one or are we saving that for the second episode?
Well, I think we can spoil this one. And the reason why is I feel like the killer, the culprit, is really obvious.
Okay.
In this book. Did you feel that way?
I mean, I would say I probably guessed it, but
it's like the 2/3 point in the book where it's the Sherlock Holmes and Watson just clearly state this guy did it.
Yeah, that's about right. Like the 2/3.
And point. It was not shocking. So what is more shocking is how he goes about with this sort of dastardly plan and all of that. So I think we can spoil this one.
Okay, spoilers coming.
Spoiler alert. Spoiler alert.
Pause us if you want to go read the book real quick. So The Hound of the Baskervilles was serialized in the Strand magazine and published in book form in 1902. The tale is set prior to Sherlock Holmes' shocking death. Wait, you're telling me more stories. In the 1893 story, The Final Problem. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I'm just learning a lot right now, so you can learn along with me. His death had enraged fans, many of whom canceled their subscriptions to The Strand, and rightfully so. I'm going to cancel my subscription to The Summary.
I'm not subscribing anymore. I'm done with The Strand.
Holmes and Watson hear the story of Hugo Baskerville, who imprisoned a young woman at his Dartmoor estate in Devonshire, England, in the 18th century. Hugo ultimately fell victim to a supernatural hound as he pursued the woman, she escaped the imprisonment, along the moors one night. The recent death of Sir Charles Baskerville on the moors has rekindled local suspicions and fears. Holmes is called upon to protect Charles's heir, Sir Henry Baskerville, who has received an anonymous warning and is being trailed by a bearded man. Holmes announces he's very busy in London, and he sends Dr. Watson to accompany Sir Henry to Dartmoor to be his eyes and ears. Once in Dartmoor, Watson meets siblings Jack and Beryl Stapleton. Beryl mistakes Watson for Sir Henry and warns him to leave. Many unsettling events occur. Watson learns an escaped convict is on the loose. Hears a hound howling and sees a mysterious figure wandering the moors at night. Watson soon discovers that Barrymore is aiding. Did we say who he is?
Did I say who?
Barrymore is like the house butler.
Oh my goodness.
Who's aiding the escaped convict, who turns out to be his brother-in-law. Watson also discovers that the mysterious figure is none other than Sherlock Holmes. Who has been conducting his own secret investigation and hurts Watson's feelings. Holmes has learned that Stapleton is next in line to inherit the Baskerville fortune. Stapleton has plotted to kill his relatives using a vicious hound that he has painted with phosphorus to appear sinister. Holmes uses Henry Baskerville as bait to catch Stapleton. As Henry crosses the moors on a foggy night, the hound comes for him. Holmes and Watson kill the beast just in the nick of time. Stapleton flees the scene and is swallowed up by the Grimpenmeyer.
The Grimpenmeyer. Mm.
Yeah, I got actually so interested in the setting of the book that I was like Googling the map of this place.
I did the same thing, yeah.
Yeah, because what did they say? It's like Devonshire, and they talked about, oh, so-and-so was in the south and at the sea. And I was like, is that in Devonshire too? What is all this? And I looked it up and sure enough, like the whole area, it seems like, is a national park now.
Yeah. Where the people are just falling into this boggy mire and dying right and left. I don't know.
Maybe
right
it's like Yellowstone where you find a foot every once in a while or something.
It's probably a foot, yes. So the long and the short of Sherlock Holmes is Arthur Conan Doyle apparently became tired of writing about Sherlock Holmes. So he killed him.
Jerk.
And so his death occurs in the 1893 story, The Final Problem. So he brings Holmes back in The Hound of the Baskervilles.
But wait, this is after his death?
Oh, yeah.
Because it says it was set prior to his death.
It's set prior, but he brings him back and sets the story prior to his death. So he does not undo the death, but the book was written after Holmes had died in the story, The Final Problem.
This is like too much information. I don't want to know he died yet.
Spoiler alert. Spoiler
Carolyn's
alert.
Carolyn's spoiling it all.
Yeah. For the rest of you who've been under a rock like Sarah and don't know very much about Sherlock Holmes.
Which is most of you, let's be honest.
Oh, come on. We're all experts in Sherlock Holmes. Come on.
Reader, tell us if you knew that.
Yes, we want to know. Did we have more spoilers than we were aware of? Or was there just the spoiler?
Are you all Victorian literature majors like Carolyn?
Okay, no. No. Sherlock Holmes is everywhere. There's television show after television show.
Yeah, and he's
show.
Not dead in them. He's alive.
He is alive in them. That is true. But we've all become sort of Holmes experts, I think.
Oh, no. I could be exceptionally oblivious. Mm-hmm. I'm not ruling that out. Mm-hmm.
So, Sarah, let's talk scientific methods here.
Let's talk them.
We would like to, because in case, listeners, you are not aware, Sarah has a thing or two to do with Grace Sigma. And so she understands process and scientific method, and she really likes to get to the meat of the matter. She really likes to do that, you know, digging deep research and figure things out. That's kind of core to who you are.
It is.
Yeah. It is. And so Sherlock Holmes has his own process. How did you feel about his process? Did it seem like the real deal to you? Did you feel like Arthur Conan Doyle was sort of stretching a little bit? Could you have figured out what Sherlock Holmes figures out, for example, at the beginning of the book with that walking stick?
I mean, it's hard to say. I wouldn't say this is a scientific method so much, you know, because he does kind of test Watson, who comes up with a theory that is reasonable. But then Holmes comes up with a superior theory wherein he takes in more details than Watson did, like the dog biting the stick and stuff like that.
Yeah, there's this Dr. Mortimer who shows up and leaves a walking stick behind. So we don't see Dr. Mortimer right away, but all we see is the stick. And so Sherlock Holmes is able to pick the stick up and look at the stick and understand things about who Dr. Mortimer is. And Watson attempts to do the same thing. And I thought it was pretty admirable what Watson was able to do. I thought pretty good, Watson. Of course, Watson's wrong about a bunch of things. And Holmes, of course, is right.
I think it's hard to say from our perspective because neither one of the situations would occur today. You know, you're not receiving walking sticks from hunt clubs or hospitals. but I guess back in the day it was a thing. And Holmes's deduction that it's more likely a hospital than a hunt club. Mm-hmm. I mean, it sounds reasonable, but...
But what if somebody, you know, you have your business office and somebody left behind their backpack, their water bottle, their something. They left something behind. Their cell phone and, you know, it's locked, but you can look at the cell phone and see various things about the cell phone and the cell phone case and the... You can see something about it and it tells you it helps you identify who the person is who's going to come pick up that cell phone, for example. Is that possible?
I mean, I suppose it's possible, but it was a pretty specific stick with like with initials on it. And is it reasonable to deduce that a doctor, because they both guessed country doctor, who walked a lot.
Yeah, so that's the one thing Watson got right, I think.
I mean, I think it is reasonable that a doctor's more likely to get a stick from a hospital than a hunt club.
Yeah, so that seemed more obvious. The initials are CCH and it ends up being Charing Cross.
Yeah.
Hospital.
It sounds a little bit, maybe that's what it is. It's like a difference between how much of your own self are you incorporating into the deduction versus how even-handed are you in the deduction? And, you know, maybe Watson's a hunter or something. So
right. So he's thinking hunting.
Yeah. And country life, I think, was notorious for hunts at the time. But
sure.
I mean, Holmes is a little over the top. So it's always just on the edge of reasonable, which I think is why we like him. You know, I'm reading him, and then also in this point he was like so rude to Watson. He's so rude.
He really is rude.
Watson just like laps it up.
Yeah, I mean, like, explain what he does, because it is pretty rude.
Yeah, so how did this go? He started talking, and it sounded like he was complimenting Watson on his deductions, and Watson's like kind of preening about he did a good job with a stick or something, which in itself is a little weird. Like one friend is the master and the other is the pupil, when they didn't start off that way.
Right.
And then he's like, no, it's not because you're right or anything. It's like Watson is the conduit, which magnifies Holmes's brilliance.
It's like he's the muse. It's like he's someone sitting for a portrait with a, you know, major painter or something like that.
Which, and I kind of get, because I'm a person that kind of reasons my way to a conclusion through argument. And so sometimes you need that foil to say something that you can converse with and through to get to your conclusion. But I've never experienced that. This foil is always wrong, so that I can always be right. You know, like they make me more luminous,
right,
or anything. So it was very one-sided, but Watson was like pleased about it nevertheless.
Yes. Yeah, so Holmes says to him, "It may be that you are not yourself luminous, but you are a conductor of light. Some people, without possessing genius, have a remarkable power of stimulating it." Now, if someone said that to me, I'd probably have a few words for that person.
You know what's wild, though? You sent me this other short story.
Is that the short story that you read that I didn't read?
I read part of it. Oh. I read enough to where... What's this guy's name?
Is it Martin Hewitt?
Yeah, Martin Hewitt says almost the exact same thing to his best friend, who, like, writes about his exploits and is like... I think I even underlined it because it was so outlandish. Mm-hmm. It's wrinkly because I was reading in the bath today.
This is a contemporary of Arthur Conan Doyle's here.
"Not because you're particularly clever, you know, because between ourselves, I hope you'll admit you're not." I was like, wow, he really is very Holmesy in there in that comment.
So you probably wouldn't take it very kindly if someone said something like this to you.
No, I would be like, you jerk.
Yeah. Yeah. And yet Watson takes it okay.
He does. And I don't know what that's about. Is that like a real thing people do? Like, do some folks have a tendency to subordinate themselves to others? I mean, I feel like I do see that from time to time.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hesitate to say I've seen that in male friendships, maybe.
You have quite a bit.
Yeah. Oh, like the admiration aspect, like the puppy dog aspect.
I hadn't thought about that till you just said that, but I've seen that too.
Yeah, so I don't exactly understand it, but, you know, that's the concept of sort of the alpha and the beta.
Like one person's sort of in awe of the other, and any kind words, even backward, you know, sideways kind words are just, they bring you pleasure. Like Watson says, his words gave me keen pleasure. And I'm thinking, are those the words I just read that he said to you? Because that's crazy.
Well, like the relationship seems to have shifted a bit since we first were introduced to the pair, where they're like, you know, sorting each other out as roommates and just kind of learning about the other one. Yeah. And now, like, it's like Watson's almost in his employment or his assistant. Or like, he's like, hey, Watson, why don't you go down to Devonshire without even running it by him?
Right. Yeah.
And Watson's like, okay. Okay, then.
So he kind of takes them for
granted. I'll write you some reports.
Yeah. Because, I mean, here are two guys. One has a lot going on. Holmes says, oh, I'm so busy with work. And then Watson, of course, has nothing going on.
Yeah, because he's, I guess, still on his medical leave or something.
Yeah. And so he's, you know, at Holmes's beck and call.
So I'm reading about Holmes. And it felt like a phrase I hear a lot currently, which is like, they're on the spectrum.
Yes.
And I think probably so, you know, like someone could say something like that rude and think they're making a compliment. And Holmes is just kind of like that all of the time.
Right. So when he calls Watson a conductor of light and says, well, obviously you're not a genius, but you inspire genius in others.
Like me.
Those are thoughts that might go through some people's minds, maybe. I don't know. But not everybody would say them.
No, definitely not. And it kind of made me think, like, is that part of Holmes's endurance? You know, none of these other characters we've really read about have endured up until, like, you know, still being major motion picture material.
Right.
I just feel like...
So we have an affinity for the quirky outsider.
Right.
Kind of,
yeah, like oddball person. Some kind of socially inept savant. We love those people.
Yes.
I don't know what it is. Why do we do that?
I mean, maybe they seem so different and interesting. Also, I mean, in the Victorian, Edwardian era, I think having a character who's a little off kilter is more interesting than having somebody who, you know, seems like everybody else, who blends in with the pack. I think of all of the heroes in Wilkie Collins books, and I mean, they're hard to distinguish and hard to remember because they're just like heroes, save the day, really, you know, handsome men. They're, you know, honest and true, and they play an important role in Wilkie Collins' books, but I think we remember Sherlock Holmes because he is distinctive.
Is it because he's so different, or because we like envy that, you know? Do we want to be kind of... It's like he's just on the edge of achievable, you know? Like the whole walking stick thing. It's just right on the edge. Like, could I have figured that out? Well, not by looking at your water bottle. It has no indicative marks.
Right.
At all. But right.
I don't know. Like, when Watson was figuring out what he thought had happened to the walking stick and then trying to determine who the owner of the walking stick was, I felt like Watson. I felt like, I think I could probably do about as well as Watson could do. And then Sherlock Holmes comes in, and he's, of course, perfect. He figures every single thing out you can find out about one walking stick. I don't know. I don't envy Sherlock Holmes. I wouldn't want to be Sherlock Holmes per se. He seems very isolated in his own way. He seems in his own head. He's exceptionally bright in some areas and exceptionally dense in others.
I mean, the same could be said of Watson, though. I feel like he's not making any friends out there. He's just like adoring Sherlock Holmes and following him around.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. You know, he's sort of like the, you know, Victorian housewife almost, like sitting there waiting to be told what's needed and what should he do next. And yeah, it's a very strange, fawning role that in Victorian literature would probably more traditionally be played by a woman.
I mean, maybe, but we do have, like, Poe's Dupin, who had his own, like, fawning roommate.
He did, but the roommate didn't seem as fawning to me. First of all, like Watson, the roommate in Edgar Allan Poe's stories is the narrator. We never even learn that guy's name. And he seems to have sort of an elevated sense of self where he lumps himself and Dupin together over and over again and, you know, makes fun of the police.
Yeah, like he sees himself as his associate.
Yeah, but it's... I remember reading the Poe stories, Murders in the Rue Morgue, for example, Purloined Letter, and thinking, hey, narrator, you haven't done anything.
Yeah, he doesn't do anything smart. Like,
why are you, you know, it's like success by association.
Yeah, we're friends, therefore.
Therefore, I'm also level. Amazing, and I'm also really bright, and I can also look down on the French police and say... you know, they're very stupid and we are so bright.
Yeah, that's true. The Poe's detective doesn't actually say anything insulting to his roommate. He just dazzles him with his know-it-allness.
Right. Whereas Watson doesn't seem to lump himself in with Holmes quite the same
way. No, not at all. It's very much like a teacher and student. Mm-hmm. And Holmes is always giving him pop quizzes, which... My friends love when I do that.
So, do you do that?
No, I don't do
I've
that.
Never got... I want a pop quiz. I want one.
No, I would do that when I was a trainer.
Oh.
So when I would train, you know, I'd go through all this training and then mm-hmm. I'd just walk through and ask people questions and they definitely hated it. Like, everyone hates it.
Yes.
But that, like, that level of stress is actually super great at, like, what is it? Consolidating the learning.
Okay.
So that moment where you have to answer the question and you're like,
it like makes it stick.
Oh yeah, you're never gonna forget it once you walk.
You
through
just
that.
Have to be terrorized by your trainer.
I'm and very you nice.
Remember,
very nice.
Remember everything. Very very nice.
I am very nice.
Yeah, you are very nice. Yes, I would agree with that.
But it's a stressful situation. I mean, just even this Watson Sherlock Holmes mm-hmm. situation where suddenly. You know, the guy that you think is the smartest guy in the world's like, what do you think about this stick, Watson? And you know he's judging your every word and he knows if you got it right or not. Even if you're best friends, that's stressful.
But he's admirable. I think Watson is admirable. He takes the challenge and I think he does at least as good a job as I would do. I couldn't do what Holmes does, but I think Watson did a pretty good job.
Maybe I am just a little bit of a weirdo, but I do have this sort of mental hobby of putting the pieces together and trying to come up with, like, what's the situation? I actually did it earlier this week.
What did you situation. Do?
Well, I won't go into any details, but I was kind of putting the pieces together, and I was like, I think this person has this background, and this is why this behavior is coming across in this manner.
Okay.
And man, if the next day did not bear that out to be correct, I was really congratulating myself.
Wow.
Yeah, we had a conversation and they were like, hey, well, so this is my background. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I knew it. I was glad I had said it out loud to Nate so he could back me up. Maybe I'm a little like, maybe it's just me that I'm kind of like, oh, could I do that? Mm-hmm. Could I really do it at that level?
Mm-hmm. Were you consciously testing yourself? Were you trying to be in Sherlock
Holmes?
I think
so, because it's not a situation where you always find out if you're right or not.
Okay.
You know, like if you're sitting, you know, you're thinking about a friend of a friend, or you're sitting at a restaurant, mm-hmm. like looking at, you know, a couple across the restaurant and amusing yourself. Like, right. What's going on there?
Right.
You'll never know a lot of stuff if you're right or not. But every once in a while, you do find out.
Right.
If you called the situation or not.
Not everybody comes back for the walking stick.
No, they don't. Exactly.
Like that walking stick sits there forever, and then, you know, Holmes and Watson are at a standstill where, is it a country doctor or some guy who's out in the country hunting?
They need some firewood. You'll never know.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. You break that thing up and, you know, you burn it on a cold night and you never know about the walking stick.
What was interesting to me, too, and I don't know if you agree with this or not, but I felt like not just their relationship changed, but he seemed to be kind of a slightly different Sherlock Holmes.
Than A Study in Scarlet.
Yeah, the first book we read.
Mm-hmm. Which was his first book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, he seemed to have more weaknesses, mm-hmm. or, like, you know, Watson kind of described him as sort of preening under compliments. And, mm-hmm. and the whole book wrapped up with kind of a discussion on, like, getting credit for things.
Yeah. Which was a theme in A Study in Scarlet, where yeah. he was saying these, you know, Lestrade and the other police detective, they were going to get all the credit if this murder was solved by Holmes. So Holmes said, well, I'm not even sure I'm interested in solving this murder because no one's going to know that I did it. And so it's sort of backward, or I guess it went two directions for me in Study in Scarlet, where it seemed like he was not asking for that kind of credit or seeking it out, and yet at the same time was making decisions potentially based on whether he got that credit or not.
Well, and kind of Watson mentioned, like, he was, like, Watson's by this time, I guess, been publishing a lot of stories about him, and Holmes is just kind of indifferent to it. Whereas in the first book, he would have, you know, not been indifferent to it.
Right.
And I don't know if this is a natural development, you know, like, now that he's getting plenty of credit in the eyes of the public, and it's a well-known personality, maybe he doesn't crave that anymore. Or if it's just kind of like the author has
figured out the character.
Yeah, like just kind of modify the character over time. Now, you said figured out, and that's a little bit different than if it was unintentional. At least it sounds different. Tell me what you mean by that.
Wait, so what do you mean by unintentional?
Well, I almost mean like he kind of forgot Sherlock Holmes' personality and just kind of reinvented a new one.
Maybe. I mean, we can't know what the author did or did not know or what he intended. I would think it's more like when you do a pilot of a television show, and, you know, I can think of so many pilots. I mean, think of two shows I love, The Office and Parks and Recreation, have terrible, in my opinion, terrible pilots, and terrible pilots are common. And I think part of that is you're figuring out who these people are and what their dynamic is and what their backstories are. And then later in that season, or maybe in the second season, you're really starting to like get into that groove and you're building up what you've been figuring out about those characters as they come to life, either on the television show or in Sherlock Holmes on the page. And so I think the characters necessarily evolve. And in a series book where you have a bunch of Sherlock Holmes stories, unlike a standalone mystery, I think almost necessarily the characters evolve. Not just on the page, but also in the author's mind.
Yeah, I'm really interested in your take on this, as you are an actual author. So when you write about characters fictionally, how does that work for you? How have you changed characters over time? Do you have to go back to the beginning and rewrite them?
Oh, I go back to the beginning and rewrite. So, yeah, the first time I started writing my novel, I thought, I'm going to have to do an entire revision of this book from beginning to end. And it was daunting. Yeah. And then years later, I realized I had to do 4,032 revisions of the book from beginning to end. And I was like, huh, the pipe dream was the second revision. No, it's like because you have to write the draft of a book in order to understand the book. I believe that.
Yeah.
Unless you're Hemingway, which, you know, you can like, you know, make cocktails and in 6 weeks pop out, you know, The Sun Also Rises. Most of us are not Hemingway. Most of us are figuring it out as we go. So you write the book and you're like, at the end of the book, you realize these are the things that mattered to me as a writer. These are the things that matter in the book to the characters. These are who these characters are. And then you go back to the start and you make sure that those... That the story, that the characters, that the setting, they're all lending themselves to the things you've been learning about the book you yourself are writing. And there's a whole different element at play in a series that features the same set of core characters in multiple books, where to just, you know, in every book, Sherlock Holmes is pompous and he plays the violin and it gets maybe a little stale. And so you've got to surprise a little bit. And one of the surprising things for me in this, Hound of the Baskervilles, is the friendship between these guys, where Holmes seriously seems to think Watson is his friend. And I thought, that's pretty cool. Because he's sort of an oddball, possibly on the spectrum. You know, we don't know. He's a little out there. He legitimately cares about Watson. He legitimately is worried about Watson's well-being and safety and all this stuff. Like, I think that's a cool element that we don't see in A Study in Scarlet.
Yeah, that's true. I feel like maybe you should just write shorter books so you don't have to go back and revise the character.
My dream is, my magic trick would be to write a book like Ernest Hemingway supposedly did. Did he really? We don't know. But, you know, you sit down and 6 weeks later you have, The Sun Also Rises.
Yeah.
Which is not a long book, but it's a beautiful book.
It is.
And most of us couldn't write that book in a lifetime, let alone in 6 weeks. And in my perfect world, it wouldn't take, I don't know what I'm on, 20, 25 years. No, I'm just joking, but a long time working on this book. And it would be closer, maybe a little closer to 6 weeks.
I know, folks like that, they're very discouraging. I remember I turned 20 and I was like, my life is over. Picasso had his first show in Paris at 20. So what have I done?
Well, wow, at 20. Okay.
It's just not everybody's the same.
That's a lot of ambition there. That's a lot of ambition. 20 years old. Mm-hmm. I know with The Hound of the Baskervilles, you felt the setting pretty deeply.
Yeah, I loved it. I really liked it. I think I mentioned I was Googling it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you had some words here on the setting. London versus Dartmoor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, two very different settings, right?
Seems like it.
So let's think about, authorial intent, right? So Conan Doyle could have just set the whole book in London, or he could have set the whole book in Dartmoor, but he goes back and forth between the two. What are your thoughts there? Those are two really different settings.
Yeah. Well, it a little bit, not nearly to the extent, but he does seem to like the scenery switch. A Study in Scarlet was extreme.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh, we started a new book about Utah.
Okay.
Cool. What's this book?
And if you have not read A Study in Scarlet, you must, keep listening to this podcast. Don't stop now. But after the podcast, read A Study in Scarlet and also read The Hound of the Baskervilles. So good, both of them. And you're right. An extreme difference in setting.
And this one wasn't quite as extreme, I guess. They're both in England. But it does go from sort of the foggy London town to the countryside, but also this kind of foreign feel, this primitiveness, where he talks about all of the old primitive dwellings and the monoliths and the mire and the bogs, and these ponies are drowning in bogs. It was very never-ending story, I would say.
And the Grimpen Mire, which, Grimpen is a made-up word, I believe. Yeah, I believe Conan Doyle came up with it. The Grimpen Mire. It's just so, it's kind of awesome.
But they do have that bog down there. I figured it was, its actual name, but
I don't know. My understanding is that he came up with it. Listeners, am I right? Am I wrong? Hmm. Help us.
Devonshire does have this moor as their national park down there.
Yeah, so. And it is, it is boggy. There's a mire. Our ponies falling into it and never emerging?
Hopefully not still, but yeah. That, well, they were kind of like wild ponies.
Okay.
They were like the Meyer ponies, the Moor ponies.
And how did they not know better?
Well, it sounds like it looked like grass.
Very deceiving.
And then you step in it, you know, because the way I think it's like these bogs, and but this green stuff floats on top. I could be totally wrong here.
So it's kind of like the shifting sands in the Moonstone.
Remember? Yeah, yes.
Yeah, like this really like unsafe, unsteady ground. And, you know, you step on it at your peril.
Apparently England's full of this
stuff.
It's
full. I mean, it's very terrifying.
It is full of these primitive things. I liked that part. I haven't been to this area, but I have been up in Scotland and over in Ireland. Mm-hmm. And they still have so many of these primitive things.
Yeah.
I remember, you know, on our honeymoon, we were on the Isle of Arran.
Mm.
And after dinner, I looked up this area of just sort of these monoliths. Mm-hmm. I was like, well, let's go look at that.
Yeah.
Man, it was just sheep fields and sheep and monoliths. Yeah. There was not another soul there.
Wow. Yeah.
But this stuff was everywhere. Mm-hmm. And it's just like almost uninteresting, I guess, because no one else is out there looking at it or any other tourists.
But on the Arran Islands, people are looking at it.
Just not when you were there. Looking at it.
I mean, you know.
Yeah, you just had to go into someone's private sheep field.
It was off of the time. It was off schedule from when the boat landed,
I guess.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was very cool, and it is kind of eerie, but it's neat to kind of to see that that's all there.
Yeah. I love that setting. I love the Dartmoor setting, the Baskerville's Hall, and I don't know. I could easily spend a month there. I felt like I could at least.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that I thought was really cool, it definitely resonated with me, is when Sir Henry is kind of going out there. Mm. And he starts getting so excited about the countryside and kind of his past. And like he was really feeling that. He was feeling like, this is my home. And then you find out, like, well, he's never been to Baskerville Hall in his life.
Yeah.
This is all new. But the countryside felt like home to him. Have you ever felt like that?
Yeah. So it's interesting. Two places that are not dissimilar. One is Salta in Argentina.
Okay.
And the other is Taos, New Mexico, where the very first time, I've been to Taos many times, and I've been to Salta only once for several days, but only one time. I felt in both places, I've been here before.
Do you have like a history there or like family history there or anything? Really?
Well, that's a good question. I have, in Santa Fe, I have had a relative who's a major painter. Who was a major painter, Robert Daughters, and his works are in various galleries in Santa Fe. He has passed. In Argentina, no. But, I mean, there was something about when I was in Salta, I just, in my bones, I felt that I had been there before and that I could easily have spent a year there. I mean, I just didn't want to leave there.
That's cool. I'm glad you said that. Mm. I felt that too. But not about so my main name is McMurray and like the Murray clan was all over Scotland.
Yeah.
And I have to say I've been there a few times and each time I go, it like feels right.
Yeah.
The climate feels right, the scenery feels right, and I'm just like, oh, my spot.
Yeah.
I'm here, finally, in my spot. This is right. Mm-hmm. And there's just, you know, I'm like looking at Scottish island real estate and stuff like that.
Are you doing that
oh,
now?
I do, yeah. Oh, I always am looking. I'm like, oh, I'm going to be on island one day.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, it feels so right. And I wonder, I'm like, is this... Is there something about like a family history in a place, or maybe there's not, or maybe there is? It sounds like
so, like almost... genetically, you know, if your family's from a specific area, maybe you have that sort of in your DNA in your bones.
Yeah,
and then I'm pretty sure I mean, I don't think I have any family from Argentina. So maybe, you know, you have a spiritual home as well or something like that, where you have this connection with a place. For me, it's something about a desert area, mountainous, you know, where it's almost a flat scrub bowl, flowers springing up in unexpected places, and feeling that you could just keep going up and down hills in it, just out of sheer curiosity as to what's over the next pass, and that you could do it forever. And I love that idea that you get up to the top of a hill and you see further and farther than you did from down below. But then in front of you is another dip and another hill, and it just goes on, it seems, forever. And there's something about that landscape, the wildness of it, and also just the unexpected beauty of it. It just, I don't know, it moves me. And certainly anytime I go to Taos, or just really to New Mexico, I feel that. And then in Salt, I probably felt it stronger than I felt it anywhere else before.
That's interesting. You said two words that are the exact same words I would use, which is wildness and beauty, mm-hmm. whenever I think of like the Scottish countryside mm-hmm. when I look around.
But in this book, it's sort of described as if it's like, this sort of wildness isn't necessarily beautiful. It's scary.
Yeah, and this has come up several times in these Victorian books. And you brought up the Moonstone, where it's the same thing, where they're like, this is the most gross beach ever.
And I know, and you and I said, like, this beach sounds okay.
Yeah, I'm like, aren't 100% of beaches great?
Yeah.
Like, that's the deal. Like, beaches are commanding mm-hmm. and beautiful, mm-hmm. but they like, this beach is ugly and awful. Mm-hmm. It's kind of the same here. They were just constantly creeped out, even though Sir Henry also had this love of the countryside and his home and his family name and that sort of stuff going on too.
Yeah, it's interesting, but Conan Doyle or Watson or whoever we want to ascribe this point of view to, is, you know, this is a sort of dark, desolate, lonely place. It's not lively and full of culture and maybe the beauty of the city the way London is described. It's like this antithesis of that. It's this old world hearkening back to something dangerous and deadly.
Yeah. Yeah, you were kind of thinking about the Grimp and Mire almost in metaphorical terms, mm-hmm. sort of representing Dartmoor being stuck in the past.
Stuck in the past, yeah. Yeah, as you know, the mire that, you know, is responsible for at least one, if not multiple, deaths. You know, people are walking on the Grimp and Mire and, you know, they're lost forever. It's like the past can destroy you.
Yeah, it was very bizarre to me where they're like, where is this escaped convict? We haven't even checked all of these primitive homes.
Yes. Yeah, there's only like 8 of them too. So why couldn't they just check?
It's like they're just waiting for him to come out of the moor and then they'll catch him.
I'm here.
They're not going to search here the I moor.
Am. Yeah. I thought that was a really interesting addition to the story. There's this guy, Selden, who is a criminal. He has escaped prison, and I mean, he's a really bad guy. Like, he is all kinds of bad. And Watson knew the case because he had either heard it from Holmes or that he had discussed it with Holmes. But he was a violent murderer. And so he's now wandering the moors, and Watson discovers that Barrymore, who is the manservant, is providing clothing, food to support Selden, because Selden is Mrs. Barrymore's brother.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was an interesting aspect. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, throwing a whole nother criminal in there leads this additional confusing factor, which I think the story needs, but also like, the way Mrs. Barrymore would describe their relationship, mm-hmm. I thought was really sweet.
Yeah. She's she's very upset and wants to help him because she remembers him when he was a child.
Yeah.
You know, like she has these fond memories of when he was a child. And so when he dies on the moor, as he does, she's weeping and she's very sad. And we know, like, this is a really violent, violent guy. And yet here she's crying for him. I mean, there's something very human about that, that I don't know, that always gets me. It's, but then I'm torn about it as well. It's this, it's the thing where you harbor, you hear the news stories, right? Someone has committed a crime and the family harbors the mm-hmm. killer.
Yeah.
Something they would never do unless it was their daughter, their son, their,
of course.
Yeah. And it's justified, I guess, by the fact that you can't let your flesh and blood be turned over to the authorities.
Well, you always know them in another way. Mm-hmm. And I'm reading this and it's very tender. And then I'm just like, well, how realistic is this? Mm-hmm. I don't know. You know, when they kind of describe how Selden goes wrong.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, well, we indulged him too much as a boy. So they kind of spoiled him.
Mm-hmm.
Then he fell in with bad companions.
Yeah.
Then became a brutal murderer.
And but then, to what degree does that affect or potentially justify the adult man he becomes?
Right, right. Is that like...
I mean, does every person who had a troubled upbringing become a murderer?
No. But then you become difficult. Well, I wouldn't say troubled, difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But it's complicated.
Yeah.
Like raising kids.
Yeah.
You know, and so I'm always wondering, like, what are people doing? How are they doing it?
Mm-hmm.
What's the right way to do it? You know, because this here is talking about they spoiled him.
Right.
And he became self-centered.
Sure.
Or in modern parlance, we might say he's narcissistic.
He's privileged. He's, yes. Yeah.
He thinks the world's all about him. Well,
yes.
You do see that. You know, you see articles about lowered empathy and mm-hmm. this and that and mm-hmm. all the things that lead to lowered empathy. But,
sure.
But do you become a murderer? Usually not.
Right. So this is an extreme response. And yet, even in this story, Mrs. Barrymore is sort of laying out the groundwork for how this child became this adult monster.
Yeah. And so I just wonder, it's like, it's the whole story seems a little extreme. It's relatable and yet very extreme. And, yeah. You know, when Watson finds him, he's like, he looks like an animal and his sunken eyes and his, like, it's just almost non-human.
Right. And so then you get into the, you know, if you're behaving like a monster, you're a killer. Does your physicality necessarily reflect the actions that you're committing? Is there a one-to-one correlation? Or do the actions you're committing transfigure or transform your physicality so that you start reflecting the monster that you have become?
I mean, the Victorians seem to think so,
mm-hmm.
although I would say a lot of modern murderers are known for kind of being charming.
So. Well, Stapleton is a murderer in this book,
yes.
And he doesn't look like a crazy monster.
That's true. That's very true.
Yeah, ladies, man.
He apparently is. I'm not quite sure how he pulled that off.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you have two really different murderers, where mm-hmm. I guess the less charming one...
Mm-hmm.
is actually mourned by his sister.
Yeah, which is so interesting, right? She does mourn him because she remembers this child that he was, the one who clung to her hand, and she can picture that. And she wants to hold on to that memory of and she can see that in him. Like, that's still in him. And, yeah, but Stapleton has nobody to care about him truly or mourn him. Once the two women who love him understand he doesn't love them back.
Yeah, he's a lot more of sort of the charming psychopath type.
Mm-hmm. Well, Sarah, we have a whole lot more to talk about with regard to Stapleton and this book and this hound.
You haven't even talked about the hound. Did you know there's a hound in this book?
There is a hound. It's, spoiler alert, in the title of the book. The Hound of the Baskervilles. So awesome. So awesome that we have two episodes.
Yeah, so come back for the next episode.
Oh, you must come back. You must.
Well, we'll talk more about it.
We will.
We'll get to the hound, I promise.
Until then, stay mysterious.
Yeah, keep on toxicking.